Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Moon, Moo, and You, the Collective Wisdom. Joan Adams and I host this show. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Our guest today is Dean Schrock, Ph.D., author of Why Love Heals, Mind, Body, Spirit Medicine. The book reminds me that even though love is an age-old experience and concept, such as Jesus and all the holy saints preach a doctrine of love, we still don't quite get it. And why? Love is the reason for everything in life, followed closely by forgiveness, and the sooner we, quote, get it, the faster will flow a life free of resistance and suffering. So I'm really excited to meet Dr. Dean Schrock and discuss love with him. But first, here is dear Joan Adams.
Hi,
Joan.
Hey, Kate. This is
How are
a great
you?
Show. I'm fine.
Great.
To hear about love heals. I do
love.
Believe that. So I'm anxious.
We know it does. We know it does. Okay, here is Dr. Schrock. Hello there, Dean.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, it's great to hear your voice. And I'm Kate and or Moo, and here is Joan Adams is here too, or Moonvine.
And good afternoon. We're glad you're here.
Yes, thanks.
Did you hear my little introduction about how love is obviously the reason for everything, but nobody seems to understand or even think about it at all?
Well, I appreciate that, but of course, because of my scientific background, it isn't quite that simple. Believe me, in working in all of these cancer centers and working with oncologists, even though it may sound like common sense to tell a physician that, in fact, feeling loved and cared for is as impactful as radiation, chemotherapy, or surgery in the course of disease cancer, I assure you, is not that well received.
Well, I'm a nurse, and I know that. I know about how doctors are, but on the other hand, nurses are probably closer to the understanding of how love heals than some physicians. Of course, there are some that are different. As we know, Leonard Lasko was here the other week, and he certainly is not of the common ilk of scientific. You know, just everything is scientific, and there's nothing else.
No, believe me, I appreciate that. You know that Len and I are actually good friends, and I interned with Carl Simonton, and I know Bernie Siegel quite well. And Larry Dossey's become a good friend because of my association with him and his publishing my research. So clearly there are those who really do stand out, like Norm Shealy. I could think of numbers, Bruce Lipton, Candace Pert, who really have a much better sense of how our thoughts and feelings impact our physiology. But my practical and very real experience for a great many years was working in these cancer centers where, indeed, these physicians did not have that background training experience. In fact, one of the things I learned, which I had to then teach my patients as a way to help them understand that we need to consider some other things other than conventional medical care, is to realize that physicians to this very day are still not required to even study nutrition and exercise as part of their medical training, let alone looking at some more psychological or spiritual aspects and how they might impact our health.
Well, I always found it very interesting, the statistic that most Americans and probably many, many more Europeans have delved deeply into alternative therapies. So for a physician to keep his or her patients, they're going to have to change the way they see things just because of the fact that their patients will go elsewhere for care.
You know, that was an interesting finding when Eisenberg published his study looking at how many people go to alternative practitioners for a label rather than their primary care physicians, and found that they were doing that in much greater numbers. And then when he published his later study 7 years later or so, that number's increased radically. And so I enjoy telling people that there's no way this is not going to change because it's consumer driven. And I've worked for major entrepreneurs, and I will tell you without reservation that if there's a way to deliver a service profitably, there will be someone who will do it. So the more we as consumers demand and look for these alternative approaches, they will simply be available.
Well, that's very true. And then if you are you go to the doctor and you get a dire diagnosis, say, as an example, then you, for me, this is what I would do. If I got a dire diagnosis, I would then say thank you very much and find my alternative therapy immediately.
Fair enough, Joan. But in my experience, what I found is that in working with literally thousands of patients is that most of them by far really look to their physician and pretty much say, please tell me what to do, or, okay, what would you do, you know, if this were your wife or your husband or something like that. So, again, there are large numbers of people looking for other than conventional approaches, and I'm pleased to be among them helping people understand that there's much more they can do.
Right.
Yeah. It's a bigger picture than we know, than the general public knows. Yeah, that's the frightening thing, is that people don't go that extra step. And Kate and I have discussed before, our daughter-in-law did the entire alternative route with a digestive illness several years back. And yes, she saw the doctors, you know, and yes, she got the diagnosis. But then she just started reading and talking and asking everybody she could find everything. And she did, everything she could until she clicked on a formula that worked for her. You know, it takes some experimentation, I think, and a little bit of courage.
And a lot of courage.
As I recall, Joan, didn't you say that Monica, your daughter-in-law, did not really have the doctor's blessings for what she did?
Oh, no. And they had told her surgery was most likely quickly. You know, they had said, and she had a new baby and a two-year-old at home. And it was just, she said, there's no way. She said, we've got lots of living to do here, and I'm not going to have myself strapped down to a bag unless I can help it. And so she just jumped out and started. She really did a lot of studying. And we've both always been interested in that kind of thing. But, you know, she took it all the way. And she went to a workshop on microbiotic cooking and spent several days in the mountains doing that. She did aqua chi. She did acupuncture. She did, yoga. She had a yoga instructor that came to the house when she was still recuperating and taught her a healing routine that she could do. She still does it. So she didn't change just her diet. She didn't change just a supplement. She did a broad range of things until she discovered which ones were actually helping her. She is absolutely doing fantastic now. Healthy as a horse. Looks wonderful.
Great.
Has plenty of energy. Feels good. You know, I sat and watched her do it. And some of the things she tried, I thought, oh, I could not do that. She did a juicing diet one time, and I thought, there's just no way I could make myself do that. But she did it. and it worked.
But of course, she did it in the face of dire diagnoses. And,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had a serious situation on her hands, and she made up her mind that she was not going to be swallowed up by it. We also went to over to Charlotte, which is about 30 miles from here, every Monday night for a healing prayer circle, which I know was helpful for both of us. It was wonderful. But I guess my whole point is you can't say, oh, well, I'm going to take vitamin XYZ and feel better tomorrow. That's not the deal. There's a wide range of things to try, and you try them all and stick with the ones that work. That's my theory.
Yeah. Well, I'll add to that, Joan. My experience is, especially because of I think I understand the placebo effect and the power of our beliefs and expectations, that the greatest reason why any treatment works is really your belief in it. It's that powerful. Your mind is that powerful. But I also wanted to let you know that I've been part of an integrative medicine clinic where we followed the model of Dr. Andrew Weil. And indeed, in our clinic, our physician who actually did a training with Andy, we had a nurse practitioner, we had a yoga person, I was the mind-body person, we had a nutritionist, we had an acupuncturist, we did meditation. And we definitely, and in this model, allow that there are numbers of things you can do to facilitate your healing. It isn't just a conventional medical model. And also within what is now called functional medicine, they similarly follow the same approach. So whether we call it integrative medicine or some call it functional medicine, you're going to see this happen much, much more as, again, we understand much more fully that it's really about body, mind, and spirit. And the spirit part was a special revelation to me because as a psychologist, trained as a psychologist, you know, I was a little better prepared to help people think of and consider the psychological factors and the will to live. That's where I really learned in working with Carl Simonton about the importance of a will to live and doing more of which takes you in a greater direction of joy in your life, even though he was especially well known for guided imagery, which was actually my doctoral dissertation. Carl's program was much more about finding the joy in your life. And so as I taught my program to literally thousands of cancer patients, I was really pleased to do that. But the one really surprise for me was that they found this too selfish. I thought I was giving them this license to steal, as one of their doctors telling them, imagine going to the doctor and the doctor telling you that here's a prescription, you need to go do what you love to do most. But again, they found that too selfish. So when my cancer patients ended up living much longer than those getting only conventional treatment for their cancer, I had to come to terms with how could that be true, because I couldn't comfortably say it was just the will to live. And that's when I went into the realm of, you know, looking at clinically, the feedback I got consistently was when patients feel listened to and cared for and supported, or I just say loved and cared for, that's why my patients live longer, and that's why I went on to write my book, Why Love Heals, because it sounds nice on the surface, but how does this really work? So I'm thrilled, again, that you, Joan, and Kate are out there helping people understand there's definitely more they can do, and I'm pleased because of my scientific experience to be able to confirm this scientifically.
Yes.
Yes.
And we absolutely do. We need that confirmation.
Mm-hmm. We do. Don't you think too? And I want to hear you talk about a lot of things, but like the old country docs that used to come out to the house. That's part of how they were healing in those days. They loved
yes.
their patients.
The bedside manner. Yeah.
Even today, scientifically, we have an explanation for that, but I agree with you very much. It's part of that bedside manner. It's part of holding an energy that allows for a flow of what I would actually refer to as a quantum field or a life-giving energy. In other philosophies, they might call it ki or chi or prana, Holy Spirit. But when you are resonating with this quantum field, you allow for the flow of this loving energy, and it is the most healing thing you can do, actually. I'm certain of that now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just before the program, I was reading a part in your book where you said that when people feel loved by God, they have, instantaneous healing. Or they can, there's just an amazing thing that happens in that process of feeling that kind of love.
Right. I guess I don't want to say it quite is that it's a given as much as it increases the odds. But in fact, when you are resonating with this field that literally underlies everything, we now know that through the study of quantum physics, and literally four physicists in the last century received the Nobel Prize in physics for determining that underlying all of reality as we think of it physically is this energy matrix of harmony and order that connects everything. And when you're literally on the same wavelength, when you resonate with that field, then again you allow for the flow of this life-giving energy. And that's why acupuncture or other disciplines that talk about qi or chi or whatever, as far as I'm concerned, is absolutely valid. And that's why I loved encouraging people to do what brings them the greatest joy in their lives, because that's a wonderful resonant energy. So even though my patients found it too selfish, I think a great message for people is to follow their bliss, to do what brings them great joy, because, again, it is this resonant energy. And healing is a natural consequence. Health is a natural consequence.
And certainly it's what is joyful for one person is completely different for another.
Yes, it can be. And so when I was doing this work, we were based in central Pennsylvania where Penn State University is, and deer hunting was big. I can't even tell you how big. It was that big. They closed public schools.
I'm in central PA. I know how big it is.
we're in central Pennsylvania.
Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, then you do know. Well, you closed public school buck season,
yes.
First day of duck season, first day of trout season. So I grew up with this. I lived this. And so I learned to talk with my patients more personally than scientifically at times to try to make my point. But when people, in fact, we lost up to 2/3 of our cancer patients the first week of buck season. But I loved it. You know, it distressed some others thinking, oh, my God, you can't just walk away from your treatment. But I knew the impact that would have. And so it was an interesting experience to encourage people to do more of what they love and then realize only later, more fully, just why that works. Because I think it's common sense that if you have a strong will to live, that you're going to fare better. But now I feel pretty comfortable explaining this scientifically why that's true.
Your first book is about something about fishing. What is that called?
Doctor's Orders, Go Fishing.
Yes. So tell us how you came across, how you came upon writing that book.
Well, it was based on maybe 11 years of being in my position of director of mind-body medicine for all these cancer centers and having worked with literally thousands of cancer patients and their families, teaching them about the will to live primarily, but also stress management, guided imagery, numbers of things. And then when someone at Penn State in their biobehavioral health department asked if I would be willing to look at whether or not this really was effective, and even with survival, I decided to take the time to collect the data. And when we realized, in fact, that people were living much longer as a result of my program, at least with stage 1 breast and stage 1 prostate cancer, I felt it was important to let people know about the program so that they might also benefit, if they choose, to know what we did if they wanted to take advantage of this for themselves. And so the big message was this idea of go fishing, do what brings you the greatest joy in your life. But Why Love Heals was a follow-up many years later, because I had to find out for myself, but how does that really work? How, when you experience joy or when you felt loved and cared for, does it impact your physiology, and specifically with something like cancer?
Right. And how about when people are actually, you know, it may not, what you're talking about isn't necessarily for spontaneous remissions. It's for people coming to the end of their lives and being ready to do it just because of the work that you are helping them with.
Well,
Instead of being so fearful.
I think my message is for anyone who wants to get well or stay well. And I know Carl Simonton said that. But today I think we are more open to thinking and talking about prevention. And I say that rather than we're actually doing it, because we're still really remiss in following prevention approaches to stay well. So I would say go fishing, period, because, you know, the common sense is when you're busy doing what you like to do, you tend to forget your aches and pains. Well, it's really true. And people need to incorporate having fun, but go beyond fun. I mean, what really makes your heart sing? And make that part of your lifestyle. Make it a health habit, like brushing your teeth. We just need to do this. But the unhealthy message I found we've been taught is that everyone and everything else comes first, and that it's too selfish. We're not supposed to just think about ourselves. Well, there has to be a better balance in our lives between work and play and doing what we think we should do and what we really want to do and what really fills our heart.
Yeah, we were just finishing up on a customer service presentation at work today. Our nurses gave it to the whole staff over a period of four-hour presentations. And one of the things we showed was Randy Pausch speaking his last lecture before, it was originally given before Carnegie Mellon, and then he gave it before the Oprah show. And then a few days later, or, you know, within weeks, he died. But that was one of his big messages. In the face of his own death, he said the most important thing is to have fun, is to find joy. And, he wasn't really happy about the fact that he was going to die, but he seemed, you know what I mean, he had three beautiful young children and a beautiful family, but he had come to terms with it. But he was trying to impart to the world these important messages. But on the other hand, he was really doing it for his children, because he wanted them. He knew that they would be watching what he was saying in the years to come.
Yeah, I remember that. That was very, very touching. The way I used to say it to my cancer patients is, how do you want to spend the time you have left? Whether that's a little time or a lot of time. Do you want to spend it, washing dishes, dusting days, or do you really want to think more about what are your priorities and take more time to do that? And so if I were to make a list of what they would really like to do and then make a list of how they actually spend their time, this was almost always a remarkable contrast. So I would say, okay, so what's wrong with this picture? And so, again, make more time now to do what you really want to do. And this reminds me of something that came up pretty regularly also, is people go, well, I'm too busy. I don't have time to do this other stuff. And that's when I would remind them that when they were diagnosed with cancer and told they needed radiation, chemo, or surgery, and they told their physician, I'm sorry, I'm too busy, I don't have time. And it was a pretty stark way of helping them realize it's always a matter of priorities. So, again, mm-hmm. How do you spend the time you have left? Whether, again, that's a long time or not. And the thing I discovered in helping people really look seriously, closely at what matters, was to discover in the end it was all about peace of mind. What they wanted was peace of mind. And so when I thought about that and we talked about it, it still comes down to doing what you love. I will tell you, and your audience can think about this now or later, but the greatest way you will find you have peace of mind is when you're doing what you love. The key is to do it guilt-free, but it's the one thing we want, and what's keeping us from doing that? And I think we need to think more seriously about, so what do we want out of life, and how do we get it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a daily decision.
Yes.
It's how do I want to spend my life today? How do I want to spend my time today?
Indeed, but also in terms of looking forward, because I was working with people thinking, cancer was terminal, whether or not it wasn't, is so okay, but indeed today. So I would say, you know, take an hour at least every day when we made up their list of things they love to do, and doctor's orders, that was your prescription, you had to do something from your list every day.
That's a very motivational thing, yeah. What you're describing, making lists of the things that you love to do and look at them every day and do at least one thing on those lists is a daily act of motivation.
Right, and also I found that the big three by far, even ahead of deer hunting and fishing, was their spiritual beliefs, family, and their friends. And so another way to have them think about it was, okay, so in terms of what you're doing, how is it helping you accomplish what you really want in terms of relating to your spiritual beliefs, family, and friends? And if what you're doing isn't really helping you get what you want out of life, then maybe you want to rethink what you're doing and spend more time doing what you'd really love to do. And the research is really quite clear at the end of your life. If you were to look back and ask yourself, what would you do more, what would you do less, you would always play more and work less.
Yes. You would look, it's a very good exercise to do that. You know, if I were on my deathbed, would I really want to be doing more of this? Or would I rather be, you know, going out dancing? Or, you know, what would I rather do? And think of it from a deathbed perspective. I always find that to be a wonderful way to mark out my priorities.
Yeah, I remember one time attending a hospice workshop where nurses were trying to help people understand what it's like to die. And when we walked into the room, they gave us 10 slips of paper, and we were to write on each slip someone or something that was absolutely vital to us in our lives. And if you had children or whatever, you could only put one name per slip of paper. So you can see how those papers got filled up in a hurry. And then one of the first things we had to do is throw 5 of those away. Because
Ooh.
That's what happens when you die. You can't do what you used to be able to do or have what you used to have. And that was really an eye-opener for me to come to terms with, oh, what really is important to me? And how is what I'm doing supporting what's important to me?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, what is the greatest act of love for you?
Oh, boy. You know, my marriage is so important to me. I have to admit that my wife comes to mind immediately.
Mm-hmm.
That's just important to me. Otherwise, I guess because of my own personal spiritual beliefs and, you know, connecting with spirit in my own personal way and following that guidance, that's critical. But also, I think it's very loving in the way I choose now to have dedicated my life to be this educator, whether through my writing or through my teaching, to help people find more joy in their lives, to make life more worthwhile, and give in some way, based on all of my years of study and experience, you know, how do we make life more enjoyable?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're living in Ashland, Oregon?
I live near Ashland, yes, I do. It's actually closer to Medford. My little
mm-hmm.
town is called Eagle Point. It's more headed towards Crater Lake.
Well, you certainly are in the part of the country where where your work is probably well-received. You know how the West Coast is at least 5 years ahead of the East Coast, et cetera, et cetera. And I would think that you have a receptive audience in your part of the country.
Well, Ashland undeniably is a unique community. It is very special that way. But in terms of just California or Oregon, there are a lot of conservative elements here. I remember even when I first moved to California, in that year, you know, Bush got more votes than Gore in the county where I lived. So
uh-huh.
There are these pockets of, you know, people with all kinds of beliefs and values, and I encourage them to develop their unique interests, needs, and values and be open to and respectful of others in that process.
Right. Well, that's what you have to do. That's what we have to do when we work with other people. It sounds like you're kind of like a coach in a way. I know that you are. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's interesting because that term comes up more and more. Having been trained as a psychologist, I always wondered, so what is a coach? What is there any real distinction? Because every time I seem to hear about coaching, it seemed to draw on psychological principles in a very great way. And I thought, well, how convenient. You don't have to go to school forever, and yet you can call yourself a coach and largely do what I've been trained to do. And now, when in terms of being the educator, because I've chosen not to become licensed again, I didn't want to feel too confined by the requirements within a license, and it always has got to be so scientific, is
yes.
to maybe even refer to myself rather than as a psychologist, but as a coach. But clearly, I'm a licensed psychologist in Pennsylvania and in California. But yeah, I guess you can call me a coach if you like.
Well, it just seems to me that the greatest psychologists or the psychiatrists or physicians, in a way, they are coaches. You know, are coaching people from your own unique expertise, and people, and especially where you're coming from. You know, you're talking about things that people care about. You talk about listening. You talk about the things that matter to people, as opposed to something completely unrelatable. And I understand that you are a good listener, and people need that. That's one of the greatest arts of all.
Mm-hmm. People need to be heard.
Yes.
Even with my training, I learned more in investigating why love heals, how that's so true. There's a psychologist, his name is James Lynch, who did at least 30 years of research at the University of Maryland with hypertension and heart disease, and looking at what happens when people speak compared to when they listen. And if you were to put a blood pressure cuff on someone, within 30 seconds after they begin to speak, their blood pressure raises 10 to 50% almost always. And when they stop and start to listen, and otherwise the communication becomes what he called heartfelt, the blood pressure always returned to baseline or lower and much healthier. And he was adamant in his research concluding that heartfelt communication was essential for a healthy heart. And he said even further for all, dealing with any chronic disease process or your health in general.
Well, isn't that true with the animals too? I mean, Kate and I are both dog lovers, I know, but I've always heard that your pets, your dogs, would lower your blood pressure.
Yes, indeed. Just think about how you feel when you are interacting with them, and right away that's going to be the indication. When you feel good as such, we now know through fields of study like psychoneuroimmunology and epigenetics that literally every thought and feeling you have registers within every cell of your body. And when they're more positive in a general way, your cells respond in a healthier way. Bruce Lipton talks about how, as a cell biologist, your cells basically do two things. They're either in a growth mode or a protective mode. And when you're feeling loving or in any way feeling positive emotionally, your cells are in a growth mode. And when you're stressed and feeling negative as such, your cells go into this protective mode, and they're not growing, and eventually they're going to deteriorate.
Well, it seems like what you're talking about would be one of the keys to longevity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, and that fear is a killer.
Yeah.
Fear and worry and anxiety kills, and love heals.
In fact, after looking at quantum physics and learning that underlying all of physical reality is this connectedness that actually could be called love, honestly, because it has every property of love, is that's how I'm losing my train of thought here, but it was around I apologize. I had something great to say, too.
It'll come back.
Okay.
Yes, don't worry. It's fine.
We always hear exactly what we're supposed to hear out here. It's that kind of show.
Yes. I was thinking, I made a little list before the show came on about what I considered to be acts of love, and I came up with 25 of them. Well, I won't go through all of them, but I came up with these two. I think shared laughter and shared tears is a tremendous, is just as important, or, you know, just as intense a thing as listening.
Yeah, I know when I was first teaching my program to cancer patients and talking about love, I didn't introduce that early on, but I actually taught about love even before I realized just how healing it was, and attempted to define what it was. And almost every positive thing you could think of is a factor of love, whether it's kindness or humor or feeling listened to, respected. And I explained to them as going through the process they were in getting treated for cancer, that's how they came to learn and appreciate feeling loved more, because now it really did matter when someone took the time to listen to them or to care and so forth. And so it was maybe a blessing in disguise. We could try to give this a positive spin, that actually going through this difficult experience gave us an opportunity to learn more fully what love is and to appreciate what love is.
I'm sure you're familiar with David Hawkins' consciousness scale.
Right, the power force.
Yes, power versus force and the consciousness scale. That is such a wonderful gauge of, you know, Joan, that lens I wrote about the consciousness scale, when that there's like anything under a certain, the very bottom of the scale is shame, guilt, and at the top of the scale, you have joy, love, and enlightenment. And then I think the middle of it is courage. And anything above courage is, you know, elevates your whole vibrational field. And anything below that, David Hawkins says that most of the people in the world are sort of in those guilt, hate, kind of shame states of mind most of the time. But when an elevated person comes onto the planet, say like the Dalai Lama, and the things that we're all trying to do too, what we're doing is very significant in raising the consciousness of the planet at a time when, and actually that kind of raising of the consciousness can actually save the world from destruction.
Yes, the Institute of Heart Math did research showing that within a certain proximity, I don't know, but let's just say 10 feet, that those who are having a more coherent experience in terms of, you know, resonating in this more positive fashion, that literally those within that proximity, their heart rhythms, their brainwave frequencies, you know, aspects of their immune system begin to mimic the more coherent person. So there's no question that every thought and feeling we have is an energy, and not only goes through our own bodies and has a consequence, but goes out into the universe. And that was another great rationale for people I gave to help them rethink that doing what you love most is selfish, because when you're doing that, it's this most positive, healthy energy that's going out. I remember after 9/11, when, you know, so many emails and whatever were flying around, how do we respond? And a lot of it had to do with revenge and terrorism. And I thought people were going to think I was crazy, and some did. But I said, no, our response is to go fishing. You know, do you want this energy, revenge and terrorism going out there, or do you want the energy of joy and love?
Well, there was a lot of joy and love right after those terrorist attacks. You know, people were getting together. One of the, you know, everybody helping one another, and there was a sense of awe because of this gathering together of human hearts and kindness. But of course, then all the talk about terrorism kind of changed that vibration very quickly.
Yeah, there was a huge amount of fear mongering that we're still dealing with today. But I want to believe, and I'm really optimistic on it, that this is going to be turned around.
Yes.
But this was pretty tenuous there for a while, and I'm optimistic that there's a different consciousness now.
Well, there is a different consciousness in general. I think behind the scenes, whether it be the help from unseen forces, you know, like the angelic realm, the unseen forces, whatever they may be, there's a tremendous amount of help that is beyond the physical. And as the more and more people tap into that, I believe it will just also be very helpful, tremendously helpful, and healing.
Yeah, and I reveal a very personal situation in my life where, in fact, you know, I am being given spiritual guidance and have been told very directly that this earth now is filled with highly evolved spirits helping us to save the earth, you know, whether it's ecologically or to turn a consciousness around from one that's largely greed-oriented to one that's more loving.
Yes. And I think the whole thing about greed is coming to a head with, you know, the Wall Street scandals, and the health insurance industry is the most greedy, you know, group of people in the world. And it's coming to a head because everybody is seeing it. I personally just met the whistleblower for Cigna, Wendell Potter. You may have seen him on television, or maybe you don't watch the news, but he had been working as an executive for Cigna Health Insurance, and he personally had a hand in squashing health care reform in America, which he suddenly had an epiphany, and he realized what he was doing. And he stepped out, and he now goes, he's on television, he talks about how the insurance companies really, the way they operate. And this kind of stuff is interesting because it's coming out for everybody to see. And it's no longer behind closed doors. So that's positive. That's very positive.
Right. This particular administration, I believe, is definitely taking us in a healthier direction that way. And even though, there are going to be some bumps along the road, I'm pretty optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even beyond administrations or politics, there is something else at play. And,
no, that's quite true. Just that the reality is that a lot of this is being held up. Just look at still the arguments about health care today and trying to come up with a new system. And believe me, there are a lot of people in high places who do not want this to happen. And I'm convinced that it will change because it has to change. It's a dissonant energy. And it's flawed. It can't be successful. It just can't. No.
That's why I'm so fascinated by these things coming out in the open, and it's these ideas, the energy. The world is ready for it, and there's just no doubt about it. And it's exciting. It's an exciting time to live.
Yeah.
To be alive.
You know,
to be alive. Mm-hmm.
I turned 65 in December, and I have to tell you that there's a certain comfort I have in knowing that I will have insurance, that I will have Medicare. I'm actually going to have a Medicare birthday party to celebrate I will have insurance coverage. But the point of bringing this up is, isn't it just a sin that we don't have coverage for all people, for their health? You know, every other industrialized country in the world seems so much more sane and humane this way, and we're still arguing about the appropriateness of having health insurance for everyone.
Right. Well, we're working very hard for that here in Pennsylvania. We have a single-payer health care bill, and I believe it's civilized. It's the only way to go. And it could be that Pennsylvania, I don't know why Oregon or California wouldn't be the first, but it looks like Pennsylvania will be the first to pass single payer. But the insurance companies haven't gotten wind of it, and when they do, watch out, because, you know, they'll try to define us in a way that we don't want to be defined. And that's what Wendell Potter told us. to be careful of how they be happy that the insurance companies don't know about you, you know, he said, because they will try to define you in a way, you know, like you're socialist. Well, that's, you know, absolute bull crap, excuse my language on radio. It's not socialist. It's, and I could, you know what, I could care less if it is. But it isn't socialist because in socialist countries, the health care is publicly funded, publicly delivered, and here in this country, it would be publicly delivered and publicly funded, privately delivered, and that's a whole different ball of wax. And,
yeah.
You know, we have the greatest medical. We have the greatest medical system in the world, but the poorest access. And we just need to combine a few different things to make it work because people are suffering so much. 44,000 people die a year from lack of insurance and denied care. Denied, you know, care from the insurance companies.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I'm sure you're promoting through your work and I hope to do through my book, Why Love Heals, is talk about a concept of oneness and that, in fact, we are all one. We need to understand this spiritually and scientifically. So we know through quantum physics the truth of this, but also when I was first working out of school and in a rehab hospital, I worked primarily with people recovering from strokes, and I was really pretty naive at that time and thought, okay, we just figure out what your diagnosis is, what we need to do for treatment, and we fix you. And when I realized the amount of suffering that went on in that process, I was feeling a little helpless myself. And so I started to investigate more closely, you know, suffering and how do we deal with it. And that's when I discovered that every philosophical system, every major religion has two primary beliefs. My sense of humor was that I found, in fact, that they disagreed on almost everything, but they managed to agree on two things. And one was that we are one with everything. We're one with God. And I thought on one level, boy, that's blasphemy. But here it is in all of these spiritual texts, including the Bible, making very definite, clear, direct statements that we are one with God. And so if people would really understand the truth of this, scientifically or spiritually, then we wouldn't do anything other than love one another, take
right.
care of each other.
Right. And that would be ideal.
Yeah, because whatever you do has a consequence on the whole. You're not this independent system that doesn't affect everything else.
Yes. And that, you know, that would be true of all the separation that occurs with politics and what happens with administrations and so forth. That is just such, it's just so sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're right. It's something that's it's happening in spite of everything. This flow is moving in a forward direction, and there's just no stopping it.
I believe that.
There's no doubt about it. And your work is helping it flow a little faster than it would normally be flowing. And we certainly appreciate it. Yeah. Go ahead.
This really fills my heart. I really enjoy the opportunities to speak, to be interviewed like this and get out there and at least share my experience and why I believe there are these other things we can do to improve our lives. So, again, I truly appreciate that you, Kate, and Joan are able to be out there and give people like me a chance to educate people differently around what they can do this way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we haven't got many minutes left. I need to ask you one more question.
Okay.
You said your PhD is on visualization. Will you talk about that just a little?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Before I ever returned to graduate school, I actually had an undergraduate degree in psychology, but I was out of school for, I don't know, maybe 13 years before I went back to graduate school. But it was largely based on two things. One, that I had learned about guided imagery or visualization, that you could actually imagine an end result, whatever that might be. And I used it for smoking, for weight control, for changing a 15-year allergy, hay fever. And the thing that really got my attention is instead of having surgery on my knee, I torn it up playing soccer in college, I was able to use guided imagery and not have to go through the surgery. And initially, I was sure this was too good to be true. There had to be another reason other than the power of the mind to change this. And so I used to call this Walt Disney. All you have to do is wish upon a star and your dream comes true. And so one reason I went back to school was to discover, okay, so what really happened? What really was able to change my knee and these other conditions? And then the other very personal part of this is that I had been introduced to spirituality and connecting with some, you know, spirit guides, and their strong recommendation, encouragement for me was to go back to school and get my PhD because, as they said, it will open doors that otherwise might not be open to you. So that's when I realized, the more I studied, that, oh my God, there's a lot of evidence here to support the use of guided imagery in numbers of arenas, and certainly including health. And so my dissertation was titled Relaxation, Guided Imagery, and Wellness. And then again, when I got out of school, my first internship was doing a research proposal for the Cleveland Clinic, a very major, well-recognized institution, where I was going to do research with guided imagery with their breast cancer patients. And then the following year, I interned at that rehab hospital, and that's where I learned that we could dramatically help people recovering from the strokes, you know, whether we increase the mobility and otherwise the physical function of these people, and with shorter stays, that was nice. And one of the things, too, that was really very satisfying was that a lot of people came in with an amputation just below the knee or at the knee because of diabetes and poor circulation. So I enjoyed being in the position to show them how with guided imagery they could increase blood circulation dramatically in a very short time because they were usually concerned they were going to lose their other leg for the same reason, diabetes, poor circulation. So I had some very early experiences that were pretty dramatic about how you could use guided imagery very effectively to help people. And then, of course, when I got into my work with cancer, I realized this that much more strongly. But when I studied quantum physics and realized that these Nobel Prize-winning physicists were saying that consciousness creates, which is actually one of the hypotheses I came up with in my doctoral dissertation, but now I was able to study it even more closely, is it is just so important, and it's so think of something more positive that we can think of. Of course, it's a double-edged sword, but consciousness creates. We have so much control over our lives that we don't understand at all.
That's
yeah.
Right. We have no clue. We're just beginning to get there, I think. I did a little workbook on setting your goals with visual pictures. That's kind of my thing. I just believe that if you focus on an image, it makes a world of difference. And you have to think on that level. You know, I just think it makes a lot of difference. So I was really interested to hear your take on that.
Yeah, just immerse yourself in what you want. You know, think as if, feel as if, act as if.
That's old Norman Vincent Peale stuff. Did you know that?
Yeah.
I'm about your age. That's when I first learned about the act as if was from Norman Vincent Peale in the early 70s, I guess.
I would think it was even earlier than that.
Might have been. I remember that little book. I just about knew it by heart.
Yeah.
But,
there were a number of people, even a fellow named Neville Goddard, who was a great spokesperson for the power of your beliefs that way. And so today, whether we think of it in terms of prayer or guided imagery and visualization or that consciousness creates, however you understand this, this is why we were taught to pray, because consciousness literally creates. And when you're resonating with this quantum field, like Len Lascaux found in his own life and work and research, is that your thoughts and feelings at that time are even more pronounced in bringing about what you want. So this is why we encourage people usually to get deeply relaxed first and then do their guided imagery.
Yeah, I used to have one years ago, guided imagery meditation, Shaktegawan.
Oh, Shakti.
Oh, yeah.
Say it. I'm not saying it right.
I think it's Shakti Gawain. Gawain, maybe.
Gawain, maybe, that's right.
Yeah.
But I
thoroughly
enjoyed her. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Her work. She had some, revolutionized people's thinking, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I think, all of those folks, thank goodness for them, they were ahead of their time. That wasn't the popular thing at this point in time. I think people are much more accepting of that. But, in the 70s, that
wasn't
true.
I would tell you, co-authored a chapter on mind-body medicine in Andy Weil's newest textbook called Integrative Oncology. And when my colleague and I, Marty Rossman, who actually is one of the founders of the Academy for Guided Imagery, when we were doing the review of the literature for our chapter, we were even surprised how much research is there now for mind-body approaches and specifically with guided imagery. There was so much research that we ended up citing meta-analyses rather than individual studies, and all of them supported the use of guided imagery in cancer care, if only for offsetting treatment side effects.
Aha. I'm just going to change the subject a little bit. Are you familiar with the Love Illusion people?
Yes, in fact, I've connected with them very strongly, yes.
Well, they're coming on the show next week. And and one of the gentlemen says to me that what shows like this and having you on and Leonard Lascaux on and the stuff that we talk about with our other guests is called Love Media.
Ooh.
And I just found that to be so cool.
Ooh,
that. Yeah. He said to me, thank you for contributing or making a Love Media something that is becoming more accepted now. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, they've introduced me to a number of people who have certainly widened my circle of knowing there are really great numbers of great people out there really talking and thinking and acting in the most loving ways. And I feel privileged to have gotten out of my little scientific arena to become more aware that there is a very large growing community of people who are very sincere in their interest in love.
Yes, totally, there's just nothing like it, really. The whole idea of just love is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Before
we run out of time, if people want to go to my website, I have a free e-course on Why Love Heals that's another way to help spread this message. And also, when Joan mentioned about guided imagery, I'm also giving away a free track from one of my guided imagery CDs titled Why Love Heals. If people want to go to deanschrock.com, that's S-H-R-O-C-K, or heartfeltintent.com. At either website, there is a free course that I taught on Why Love Heals that's available as an audio, or we've transcribed it also, and a free download of this guided imagery track, Why Love Heals.
That's wonderful. I can't wait to get that. That'll be great next week.
Yeah, we put that up on the chat room, Dean.
Oh, thanks for doing that.
Yes, and I've taken that e-course, and I highly recommend it. It's great. It is truly, truly great. So,
well,
we have 16 seconds remaining on the program, so I really am very happy to have had you. Joan and I are very happy to have had you here tonight. And
oh, we are.
Thank you.
Delighted. Thank you so much.
Okay, and thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And now we're going to be playing the music for Mother and Child, and that would be C.D. Jensen, and it is very beautiful music. So here we go. Thank you. Love to all.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.